Good morning. European leaders are calling an emergency summit to respond to President Trump's demands for Greenland. France's finance minister says an ally has never used tariffs as a geopolitical weapon. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Three people have died in this country's largest immigration detention center in the past 6 weeks. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's a tent camp run by a private contractor. What are the conditions there? Also, Trump wants to ban large investors from buying more houses. Do they really drive up prices? And after India outlawed the selling of eggs to fertility clinics, women and girls were pushed into a black market with no protections. It is Tuesday, January 20th. Drummer, producer, and filmmaker Amir Kalib Thompson, better known as Questlove, turns 55 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump released a lot of social media messages online overnight. They included purported and private messages from the leaders of NATO and France. French President Emmanuel Macron said simply to Trump, "I do not understand what you are doing on Greenland." Trump returned from Florida overnight and again demanded control of Greenland.
"We have to have it. They have to have this done. They can't protect it."
Greenland is protected by NATO. Greenland is also controlled by U.S. ally Denmark, and both Greenlanders and Danes say they reject any U.S. control of the island. Trump is leaving today for the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where he is expected to discuss the matter further. Today marks 1 year since President Trump returned to his second term in office. This past year has seen immense government upheaval, but NPR's Tamara Keith reports there's been less turnover among Trump's cabinet and top-level staff as there was in his first term.
By this point in Trump's first term, two cabinet secretaries had left their jobs, and at the White House, a chief of staff, two communications directors, and a press secretary were among the many already gone. This time, there's been less personnel drama, says Catherine Dunn Tempest, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution.
What is the core of the stability? It was the emphasis that they put on loyalty in hiring. And that has then subsequently paved the way for less infighting and less drama and a lower rate than in 2017.
Lower and with more promotions than firings, but still sky high compared to other recent administrations. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
There are more questions about the tactics used by ICE in Minnesota to detain people. On Sunday, federal agents broke down the front door of Chongli Scott Tao, a naturalized American citizen in St. Paul. Agents forced him outside in snow and sub-freezing temperatures, wearing only his underwear. Tao said agents eventually realized he was an American with no criminal history, and then they drove him home. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Minneapolis federal agents continue to arrest people.
The Department of Homeland Security has not released a breakdown of the number of arrests made by federal immigration officers here in Minneapolis. But in a tweet, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem says there have been 3,000 in the 6 weeks since the federal surge began. NPR has not been able to independently verify that number. Several American citizens were among those detained in Minneapolis and later released. Meanwhile, many here say they plan to continue pushing back.
"I really think there is a sense of we'll do this for as long as we need to."
37-year-old resident Talia Pletcher says she and her neighbors are in it for the long haul. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Minneapolis.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are sharply lower. It's NPR. Spanish workers are using heavy equipment to lift the most damaged wreckage from a deadly train collision on Sunday. 41 people were killed and dozens injured. Spanish authorities say more bodies may be found in the two wrecked trains. Authorities in northern Indiana are still searching for a suspect who shot and wounded a state court judge and his wife at their home on Sunday. The couple are in stable condition. Police in Lafayette, Indiana, have not released a description of the suspect. The city is more than 60 miles northwest of Indianapolis. The Indiana Hoosiers are national champions in college football for the first time in school history. Indiana beat the Miami Hurricanes 27-21 last night to cap off an undefeated season. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Indiana had steamrolled their first two playoff opponents with 38 points on Alabama, then 56 points on Oregon. Miami was a different story. The Hurricanes' pass rush put serious pressure on Indiana's Heisman-winning quarterback Fernando Mendoza, and the Hoosiers managed just 10 points in the first half. But after halftime, Indiana blocked a Miami punt, turned that into a touchdown. Then Mendoza took control with two late-game fourth-down conversions, one of them a touchdown from a heroic leap into the end zone. The win completes a historic turnaround for the Indiana football program. The Hoosiers were long the bottom feeder of the Big Ten Conference. Then the arrival of Coach Kurt Cignetti changed it all. He steered Indiana to an 11-2 record last year, and this year a perfect 16-0. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
From the 1860s to the 1930s, immigrants built homes along the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, in a neighborhood called Bohemian Flats. The flats were a landing place for working-class immigrants in the Twin Cities, offering affordable housing, a place to speak the languages, and proximity to factories just a few hundred yards away. At its height, the population grew to over 1,000 residents. The homes themselves were no more than shanties, often built close together without foundations and prone to damage. Spring floods from the Mississippi River posed a constant threat, shaping daily life and the resilience of the community. The city of Minneapolis used eminent domain powers in 1915 to seize land in the southern part of the flats. Then, in late 1923, a judge ordered Bohemian Flats residents to pay rent or face eviction, prompting police to begin removing families. Led by neighborhood women, residents resisted fiercely, and the standoff ended when a judge temporarily halted the evictions. During the following few years, the city would continue to issue eviction notices to residents. The last remaining building was torn down in 1963.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. European leaders are using both threats and flattery, trying to stop President Trump from pursuing Greenland, or at least stop him from punishing them with tariffs for those attempts. Trump has been sharing leaders' private messages to him about Greenland on his Truth Social. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Democratic Senator Chris Coons, who's in Davos, where many of those leaders are meeting. He's also just wrapped up a congressional visit to Denmark about Greenland. But we're going to start with the latest from NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So Trump threatened tariffs over the weekend against eight European countries who supported Greenland, and there have been more developments. So bring us up to date.
Well, yeah, overnight here, Trump shared private messages from French President Emmanuel Macron, which the Elysee has confirmed this morning are genuine, and NATO head Mark Rutte. Both men compliment Trump on all the good things he's accomplished, but basically say, hey, what's going on with Greenland? Let's work this out. And Macron invites Trump to a dinner and a mini G7 summit on Thursday in Paris after Davos to do so. But we're also seeing an avalanche of condemnation coming from every corner of Europe, and unity among Europeans over Trump's threats of 10% tariffs on those eight NATO nations, European NATO nations, by February 1st if they try to impede his Greenland takeover. You know, yesterday the finance ministers of Germany and France spoke to the media. They were in Brussels for an urgent meeting. And here is French finance minister Roland Lescure.
I think we both agree we're living through uncharted territories. We've never seen this before. An ally, a friend of 250 years, is considering using tariffs as a geopolitical weapon.
You can kind of hear the outrage there. So how is Europe planning to push back?
Well, the EU is a market of 450 million consumers, and they plan to use that power of that market, said EU parliamentarian Nathalie Loiseau, who I spoke with this morning. Loiseau said the parliament will not ratify as planned the US-EU trade deal negotiated last summer, where there were zero tariffs on US products. She said the EU is ready to trigger $100 billion worth of tariffs on US imports if Trump continues. Here she is.
leaders and use the Atlantic Alliance to make us stronger against adversaries like Russia. He uses the alliance to try to pressure us in order to grab territory in Europe. This is unprecedented and, of course, unacceptable.
Is the idea for Europe to fully break with the U.S.?
Well, some Europeans seem ready to face that, even if they certainly hope not. So as much as they talk tough, they are still trying to make it work with Trump. You know, French President Emmanuel Macron called Trump his friend in one of those messages Trump shared on Truth Social. And NATO chief Mark Rutte flattered Trump, saying he couldn't wait to see him in Davos, Switzerland this week. Even the British have been targeted by Trump. Their special relationship and those royal visits they offered Trump have not spared them. Let's listen to British MP Ed Davey speaking in Parliament yesterday. He said Britain must act in solidarity with its European allies to counter Trump.
President Trump is acting like an international gangster. Yeah. Threatening to trample over the sovereignty of an ally, threatening the end of NATO altogether, and now threatening to hit our country and seven European allies with outrageous, damaging tariffs unless he gets his hands on Greenland.
So, you know, Britain voted Brexit, you know, just a few years ago, but now they are getting closer and closer to Europe. A few hours ago, President Trump posted a meme of him raising an American flag on Greenland alongside Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President J.D. Vance.
So doubling down, at least,
yeah, exactly.
On Truth Social. That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
We have reached Senator Chris Coons in Davos, Switzerland. He went there for the World Economic Forum after leading a bipartisan congressional delegation to Copenhagen, Denmark. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be on with you.
How, if at all, do you propose to change the discussion here?
Well, look, first is to bring back home some of the reality, the truth on the ground that our bipartisan delegation heard over 2 days of meetings in Denmark. We met with both Danish and Greenlandic leaders, prime minister, foreign minister, defense minister, parliamentarians, business leaders. And in response to a few simple questions, they said, there is no threat to Greenland now from Russia and from China. The only threat is from us. They would welcome us investing in and partnering in more Arctic security, and they would welcome us working with them to develop Greenland's resources. We have a close 225-year-old alliance and partnership with Denmark. Everything that Trump wants to achieve in Greenland, we can achieve by just asking. Trying to seize Greenland through threats of force or threats of tariffs is risking blowing up the NATO alliance or a tariff trade war with the EU. Trump is bluntly risking everything for nothing.
Well, let's talk about that. The president, in an interview with the New York Times some days back, said that it was psychologically important to him to actually own the territory. Just getting the substance of everything the United States wants is not enough for him. Psychologically important to own it as a real estate guy. What do you make of that?
Frankly, that's nuts. The idea that his psychological well-being ought to be the basis for trying to acquire a territory that is mostly rock and ice. It's three times the size of Texas, but incredibly remote with a very harsh environment. We have one military base there now that's critical to our security. Forcing its acquisition risks blowing up the NATO security, a treaty that has kept the peace in Europe and protected the United States for 75 years. The Danes are alarmed and outraged. One of the hardest moments of our bipartisan visit to Denmark was when we laid a wreath at the memorial to the Danes who served and fought and died alongside Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq. We should not risk ending these critical partnerships and alliances over nothing more than a piece on Donald Trump's mental risk board.
I want to ask how much Congress can really do about this, though. I realize you were part of a bipartisan delegation that visited Denmark. Lisa Murkowski was with you. Tom Tillis of North Carolina was with you. And yet, if we look at congressional actions over the past year, it is not hard to see a pattern unfolding. Some Republicans express some concern, but never quite enough to get to 51 to reject whatever it is the president wants. Democrats express grave concern, as you were doing, and ultimately Congress does nothing, and taxpayers who pay for Congress get nothing whatsoever from your advice. Do you think it may work out that way this time?
Look, my hope is that President Trump will walk this back when he confronts European leaders, both elected and economic, the CEOs who are here at this meeting, the world leaders who are here at this meeting, who are saying to him there are huge costs to us if he goes ahead. And there's a series of bills that have been introduced in both the House and Senate that would overturn Trump's tariff authority that he's using to threaten a NATO ally, or that would bring up a war powers resolution. But Steve, I understand why folks are skeptical, given that far too few of my Republican colleagues so far have stepped up in moments like this. But this one calls for us to act and act clearly in America's best interests.
Is this another occasion where you would say that your Republican colleagues privately believe the president is on the wrong track, but publicly are unwilling to stand against him?
Well, not just my colleagues. 75% of Americans think this is not the right thing to do. Delawareans call and ask me all the time about health care costs, housing costs, the cost of daily living. They'd like to see members of Congress and our president focus less on foreign adventures and more focused on dealing with the issues that they're concerned about day in and day out.
Just very briefly, would you agree that there is a major national security interest in Greenland? We've got about 20 seconds for the United States.
We can meet every national security interest in Greenland by partnering with Denmark. They would welcome it with open arms, and that's the best way to do it.
Senator Chris Coons of Delaware is at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Senator, sounds like you're in a cafe. Would you order me an Americano while you're there?
Yes, I will. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much.
Okay, Steve, not trying to get in your biz, but has anybody in your house gotten this awful flu that's going around?
Oh, yeah, there have been a couple of people. Not me yet.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you're lucky, and you're not alone. The CDC has recorded at least 18 million flu cases and hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations.
Wow.
And even the reported cases have started dropping. Flu season is not over.
So we asked a professor of infectious disease what works and what does not work when trying to avoid the flu. Dr. William Schaffner teaches at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and he says one common myth leaves him cold.
It's uncomfortable to go outside in the cold with your wet hair, but that really won't predispose you to getting the flu. These flu viruses and common cold viruses are indeed viruses. You have to catch them from someone else.
And that old saw, feed a cold, starve a fever? Nope.
That's an old saying, but the body needs both hydration and energy to fight off an infection. And I put the special emphasis on hydration. Keep your fluids up, regardless of the kind of infection you have. Because if you tend to get dehydrated, you're more likely to get the complication of pneumonia.
Hydration is everything. But the professor says the number one way to prevent a bad flu is... Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, get your flu shot.
Okay.
And contrary to another common myth, getting vaccinated will not make you sick.
You may get a bit of a sore arm, and some people do get a degree of fever, but that is just an example of your immune system starting to develop the protection to fight off the virus.
Now, the flu strain in heavy circulation this season emerged after the most recent flu shot was developed, but early research from the University of Pennsylvania finds the vaccine still helps.
Getting vaccinated is the single most important thing you can do to prevent influenza and COVID, for that matter.
Schaffner says that's especially important for people who are older or pregnant or those at high risk because of chronic conditions like diabetes.
If those folks are now going out indoors to crowds, put that mask back on. Keep your hand washing up and try to avoid people who are coughing and sneezing.
And if you do get sick, Schaffner has one request.
Please stay home. Don't go to work or school and be a dreaded spreader.
Dreaded spreader. He says the flu usually peaks in the U.S. in February, but the flu season can stick around as late as April. Time to get that shot.
Thank you. KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station, an extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A woman in India estimates she has dozens of biological children, and she says there are many more women like her because India has a thriving black market for human eggs. NPR's Dia Hadid and producer Shweta Desai investigated the story across India.
We meet H in a Mumbai cafe. Couples who need a human egg to have a baby like how she looks, pale skin, a pretty smile. H asks we don't use her full name because her survival depends on work that is illegal in India. She doesn't want to get caught. H estimates that over the past 5 years, she's harvested her eggs for money at least 30 times. If each time produced one baby, she'd have some 30 biological children. H is sure she's made more babies than that. H says, you can assume they've made at least 10 kids from me each time I've had my eggs harvested. She says, I'm that fertile. Producing those eggs isn't easy. When H has a commission, she'll inject herself with hormones for days. She says it stimulates her ovaries to produce about 2 dozen eggs. Under anesthesia, a doctor will insert a long, thin needle through the wall of H's vagina to retrieve her eggs from follicles on her ovaries. Depending on the client, H makes anywhere from $280 to $800. Even the lowest amount is more than the monthly wage for most jobs in India. Women selling their eggs is an open secret in the Indian fertility industry, but it's unclear how many women do it. Off tape, H tells this to producer Shweta Desai, who interprets.
There are so many of them who are doing this, who are literally running their houses on egg donation.
This is often called egg donation, but selling her eggs is how H has survived since she left her husband. He took their two children. H was homeless, and a girlfriend told her, you're young and pretty. Sell your eggs. Her girlfriend said, lots of girls do it. I've done it. Critics say this illegal market exists because India radically constrained the supply of human eggs after the government passed laws to regulate its fertility industry in 2021. The laws say a woman can only donate her eggs. She can only do it once. Supply was constrained as demand surges because women here are waiting longer to have children. Meanwhile,
women don't have enough jobs and there's a lot of need.
Prabha Kodeswaran studies the fertility industry's impacts on women. She's a professor of law and social justice at King's College London.
In that context, if you bring about a law that essentially shuts down a certain sector, it may be well-intentioned, but it is bound to have unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences. Kodeswaran says soon after the law was implemented, she found
there was a vibrant market in paid egg donations.
That market can exist because there's no central registration in India.
So there's no way of knowing how many times a woman has donated her eggs. When clinics need eggs for their patients, they often work through intermediaries who rely on people called agents, like Ruby. She asks we only use her first name. Her work isn't legal. In a month, Ruby gets about a dozen requests for egg donors, mostly over WhatsApp. Ruby says a demand is for women who are pale and pretty, like H. She finds them through her networks and social media ads. She gets paid for finding the women. We found this is how clinics and their intermediaries can claim that they aren't paying women for eggs. They're paying agents for recruitment. Ruby takes a cut between $50 to $100 and passes the rest on to the women whose eggs have been harvested. Vrinda Marva is an associate professor at the University of South Florida. She's researched this industry and says the new laws are harming people who are already vulnerable.
If something goes wrong, they're already doing something criminal. So who are they going to turn to for help?
H, who sells her eggs to survive, says she couldn't ask anyone for help when 2 years ago, a male agent sent her to a hospital to have her eggs extracted. H says she emerged from the anesthesia with swollen eyes, cuts on her lip, welts on her back, and was wearing a diaper. H fled the hospital as soon as she could. H says, if that agent, that man, did something to me, God will punish him. Amid the demand for eggs, in the northern city of Varanasi, a 13-year-old girl was lured into selling her eggs to one of India's largest fertility clinic franchises. Her parents request we keep her identity anonymous. The teenager says about 2 years ago, a neighbour who happened to be an agent told her she'd get $180 for her eggs. The teenager says she didn't understand. Eggs? Like a chicken? But she really wanted a phone. The teenager's lawyer, Krishna Gopal, believes this is happening to other minors, but there's no incentive for families to come forward. He says the clinic that extracted the teenager's eggs, Nova IVF Fertility, hasn't suffered any consequences. Nova IVF Fertility said in an emailed statement that the teenager was screened by a separate company that signed off on having her eggs harvested, and they had no way of knowing the teenager's real age. We spoke to three members of the board that advises the health minister on the implementation of India's fertility laws. They requested anonymity. They aren't allowed to speak to media. None were aware that clinics were buying eggs from women through intermediaries. Kottaswaran, the law professor, says the best way to curb the black market for human eggs is to legally compensate the women who provide them.
We think there should be contracts that are drawn up in favour of the women.
She says without the women supplying their eggs, couples trying to have a baby in India wouldn't have options.
There is an entire industry that's living off these women's biomaterial, but then you don't want to pay the women themselves.
Weeks after we first met H, who sells her eggs to survive, we reunite in a Mumbai cafe. She's bloated, nauseous, breathless. They're all signs H was overstimulated to produce eggs. In rare cases, that can be fatal. H says, I know this will kill me, but someday we'll all die, right? Dear Hadid, NPR News, with Shweta Desai in Mumbra, Chennai, Varanasi, and Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
When candidate Donald Trump was on the campaign trail in 2024, he promised to cut American energy bills in half. The costs of gasoline and oil are down, but the costs of electricity is surging.
Our grid is very old, it's aging, and it costs a lot of money to replace and repair that aging grid infrastructure.
Grading energy promises on All Things Considered from NPR News. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from National Public Radio. We bring you the news and voices of people across the nation each and every day.
We are proud of the work that we do, but we want to remind you that local affiliates like KAXE bring you the voices of your friends and neighbors. From arts reporting on area voices to local and state sports or clean energy and economic development, they reflect what life is like in rural northern Minnesota. Your support is critical to the work they do, where you learn about high school students in debate, to the sacredness of water and wild rice, to the history and future of forests in the region. Being a member makes this all possible, so please go to kaxe.org.
On today's date, January 20th, 1997, I see what I believe to be a golden eagle along the shore of Lake Superior. The golden eagle is easily confused with the juvenile bald eagle. Both are dark brown, large birds, and have few discerning differences. The one that probably is easiest to see is in flight. The golden eagle will have white under its wings and white under its tail, and the bald eagle will be more mottled. The white will not be in solid patterns. It will simply be spotted here and there. Secondarily, the golden eagle, if you're lucky enough to see it up close, will have what appears to be a mullet of golden feathers, kind of from the back of the head and down its neck onto its shoulders. And thirdly, and probably most importantly, is habitat. The golden eagle is mostly a bird of open country, fields, and forests, while the bald eagle frequents lakes and streams. It is probably worth noting that at this part of Minnesota, 99 out of 100 large dark brown eagles are going to be juvenile bald eagles.
We are going to change the label to make it available. Hundreds of thousands of kids, in my opinion, will benefit.
The label hasn't changed yet, but the announcement helped create a run on FDA-approved leucovorin tablets, which were already in short supply. Now the FDA says it's working with the drug company Pfizer to import tablets that are made in Spain and sold in Canada, but are not approved in the U.S. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Indiana is celebrating its first national championship in college football. The Hoosiers intercepted Miami quarterback Carson Beck with less than a minute remaining in last night's title game to secure the trophy and an undefeated season 27-21. Indiana finished 16-0. Wall Street futures are down sharply this morning ahead of the open. The rising political tensions over the future of Greenland are weighing on investors. Dow futures are off more than 700 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. There is growing concern about conditions at the largest immigration detention center in the United States.
And here's why. Three people have died in custody in the last 6 weeks at a tent camp, which is run by a private contractor. The most recent death happened this past week at the camp located at Fort Bliss in El Paso.
Angela Kocherga with member station KTEP is with us now with the latest. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could you just start with some background on this facility? How big is it and who's sent there?
Yeah, well, the camp has a capacity to hold 5,000 people and it can be expanded. And at the end of last year, the average daily population was about 2,800 people. Advocates and lawyers say that some immigrants picked up in Minneapolis recently are being sent to the tent facility, but people from all over the country are there. The facility is considered a hub for ICE because it's so large and there's a nearby airport for deportation flights.
So tell us about the people who have died at the facility. What do we know about them?
Well, Immigration and Customs Enforcement says 36-year-old Victor Manuel Diaz was found dead last Wednesday. He had been in custody since January 6 when ICE said agents, quote, encountered him in Minneapolis and determined the Nicaraguan man was in the country illegally. Now, according to ICE, staff at the detention camp here in El Paso found Diaz unconscious and called for emergency medical help. ICE says the death is a presumed suicide. And earlier this month, ICE reported a 55-year-old man named Geraldo Lunas Campos tried to take his own life and staff intervened to save him, but he died. Both cases are under investigation. And the third death in custody happened in early December. That was 48-year-old Francisco Gaspar Andres. He died after he was transported to a local hospital for a medical condition.
So the Department of Homeland Security oversees ICE. What does the department have to say about this?
In an emailed response yesterday to a question about medical care at the facility, DHS said it has a long-standing practice to provide comprehensive medical care in custody, and that includes medical and mental health intake screenings within 12 hours of arriving at a facility. DHS said there's also access to medical appointments and 24-hour emergency care.
And what about lawyers or other advocates for the detainees? What do they say about this?
Human rights advocates and multiple lawyers have lots of concerns, and they've documented cases of medical neglect, physical abuse, and unsanitary conditions at the facility known as Camp East Montana. And all of those were included in a report by the ACLU. Marisa Limon Garza is the executive director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center.
We know from people that we speak with every day at Camp East Montana that they are being denied access to medical attention, whether that's actual medicine or whether that's actual access to a doctor or physician.
And El Paso's Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, a Democrat, toured the facility when it opened in August, and she's calling for it to shut down.
It has never adhered to basic or appropriate standards to ensure the safety and dignity of the human beings in custody.
Escobar is among 122 members of her party supporting legislation to create enhanced oversight for detention centers and phase out private contractors over 3 years.
That is Angela Kocherga in El Paso. Angela, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Michelle.
President Trump is expected to talk this week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, about making housing in the United States more affordable. One of his proposals is to ban large investors from buying more single-family homes than they already own. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the idea is popular, but turning it into law has proven hard.
Back in 2020, Ashley Maxwell and her husband were looking to buy their first home near Indianapolis.
We looked at over 80 homes in probably a span of 2 months.
They had to move because their landlord was selling their rental.
And we would pull up to a house, our agent would get out and be like, there's 10 additional offers, sight unseen, cash offers. Typically, that means that it's an investor.
It turned out they were caught in a surge of institutional investors across the country, snapping up single-family homes to rent out.
We have neighborhoods today that are now creeping up to 35-38% of the homes have been purchased for investment purposes.
Scott Fadness, a Republican, is mayor of Fishers, an Indianapolis suburb. Last year, he proposed capping rentals at 10% per neighborhood to protect local homeownership.
It's been a source of generational wealth in our country for a very long time, particularly in the middle class, and I hate to see that go away.
Realtor groups opposed a cap, saying it infringed on private property rights and could deprive sellers of the highest bid. But the city council backed it unanimously, and the new law just took effect January 1st. It is a rare win. Cities and states across the country have debated restricting investor homebuyers, yet most failed to pass such measures. California Governor Gavin Newsom is the latest to say he's determined to do something. But housing experts say it's too easy to blame corporate landlords for skyrocketing prices.
People see the connection, but they don't necessarily separate out the cause and effect.
Economist Lori Goodman at the Urban Institute says, sure, prices go up where investors buy, but that's because they pick places that are already growing, and they often buy serious fixer-uppers.
Most of us don't have the knowledge to do the repairs. If we did, we couldn't get the financing.
Nationally, the biggest companies own only 3% of the market. The main thing driving up prices is a housing shortage, Goodman says, and investors are actually helping that now, as higher interest rates have made it more pricey to buy single-family homes. Some have shifted to building their own homes to rent.
The best way to make housing affordable is to simply build more of it, to increase supply.
In Las Vegas, Democratic State Senator Dina Neal hears that and still worries it's undercutting people shot at homeownership. One corporate investor there has built an entire neighborhood of houses to rent.
They didn't build the whole entire neighborhood to give it up. They wanted to make sure they were going to secure rental income from 200 different families and keep it.
And those rents are so high, she says, it's impossible for many to save up for a down payment. Neal has proposed a cap on corporate landlords three times. Nevada's Republican Governor Joe Lombardo has blocked it, most recently last month. So what does she make of President Trump now taking up her cause?
I am trying to figure out how I entered into a universe where I became aligned with a president who had a nemesis to the Democratic Party.
But if it persuades more Republicans, she'll take it. Jennifer Lutton, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition this afternoon. On All Things Considered, some people who use AI chatbots develop unhealthy emotional attachments to the technology or even suffer breaks from reality. Now some of those users and loved ones are turning to each other for support. Kind of like AIAA. Listen in the NPR app or on this public radio station. This is NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXC. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Again, that's psa@kaxc.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.
I-43, more news coming up from Morning Edition here on KAXC. We're people-powered radio for northern Minnesota. Check out our local news. It's available at kaxc.org or tune in for the Up North Report. That's coming up at 7:01. That's right after our student phonology reports beginning about 6:45 this morning. John Lattermill will be joining me and we'll be bringing you lots of nature information. We'd like to thank Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org. And our board of directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, January 26th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxc.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our board of directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxc.org. Coming up this Saturday, Deep Portage Learning Center in Hackensack has their annual winter rendezvous. You can enjoy a day of outdoor winter activities like axe throwing, snow snakes, and more. Registration begins at 9 with games until 2 and a chili feed at noon. Find more information at...
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Jitasa, providing bookkeeping, accounting, and CFO services exclusively to the nonprofit sector. Jitasa is committed to serving nonprofits who make the world a better place. JITASA.com. And from Clarivate, sponsors of the Pulse of the Library 2025, a global survey of academic, public, and national libraries on AI's impact and evolving priorities. The survey can be explored at Clarivate.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Indiana University has won the national championship in college football. They beat the Miami Hurricanes Monday night to win their first title. Ever. Never even been close. We called Zach Osterman to talk about this. He covers Indiana University sports for the Indy Star in Indianapolis. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I'll mention you're in Miami. You saw the game last night. I am assuming that when you attended Indiana University many years ago, you did not go for the football or see this moment coming. Am I right?
No. It's fair to say I went to do what I do now, and I don't think I ever would have told the story that we are all, or expected to tell the story that we are all kind of in the middle of at this moment. It is been remarkable to watch unfold over the last 2 years.
Yeah, and your voice is a little bit raspy. I know you were up all night or almost all night. I just want to mention this game. I got to see the first quarter before I went to bed myself. And it was interesting and impressive. The teams were more closely matched than I anticipated, but IU just seemed to have a little bit of an edge all the way through. How did you experience it in the press box?
I think that's fair. I expected a close game. Miami is a very tough team. Miami is a very, very good team along both lines of scrimmage. I think probably the best team there that Indiana's seen this season. I expected Miami to maybe, for lack of a better term, hold Indiana honest for a lot of this game. And I think Indiana, to its credit, won this game because it was the tougher team in those moments. There were a number of players who had blood on their jerseys, blood on their pants, blood on their towels after the game. And it felt almost like a bit of a badge of honor because I think they understood how this game needed to be won.
Oh, my gosh. Fernando Mendoza, the quarterback for IU. I saw blood in his mouth early in the game. Then I wake up to find out late in the game he had 2 fourth down conversions. What did he do?
Yeah, the big one, the one that everyone will be seeing this morning, and I suspect for a very, very long time, is 4th and 5 inside the Miami 10-yard line. Indiana looks like it's going to kick a field goal. Kurt Cignetti calls timeout, and then to hear it from one of his other players says, get off the field, we're going for it. Indiana calls a quarterback draw, and Mendoza actually winds up essentially shouldering a Miami defender to the ground on his way to the end zone. He doesn't just convert the fourth down, but he gets to the end zone. There's kind of what I think, what I strongly suspect is going to become an iconic moment in Bloomington, a picture of him stretching out between 2 defenders and pushing the ball across the goal line for the last touchdown of the night. And what ends up being, you know, essentially, I think, as much of a signature moment for this team this season as any, and of course there have been many.
Okay, so a lot of talent here. They benefited a lot from the transfer portal, from a couple of sixth-year seniors who had extra time on the field because of the pandemic and so forth. And yet in the end, I think we have an expression there in what you just described. This team's confidence and the coach's confidence. Had they blown that play, this game could be completely different, but they pulled it off.
That is what never broke with this team. You know, even last season, Indiana wins 11 games, but you felt like maybe didn't quite have the intangible something extra, that 2% to win a game like they did so dramatically at Penn State, to win the way they did against Ohio State in the Big Ten Championship game, another very close, physical, hard-fought game. And I think those moments, and forgive me, you're right, my voice is really abandoning me this morning, but I think those moments in a lot of ways, they felt very much prepared than for this one. And
Zach Osterman, got to stop there. Thanks so much. This is NPR News. Get some rest.
I'm Jennifer Barr, and on a recent Monday morning show, we talked with longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media and what KAXE means to him.
So that puts it at more than 20 years, 22-some years of appearing on KAXE, and I've been privileged to, you know, do the morning show, like segments like this, but also on the Great Northern Radio Show and Dig Deep. And when Heidi Holton was producing Between You and Me, I was a frequent contributor there for years and years. You may not think of KAXE as big time media, but I feel like that experience trained me. I mean, the quality that the station puts out of our programming is just amazing. And my experience, it was the fastest and easiest decision to spend money that we've had in our almost 25 years of marriage. She said, let's do it.
Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
Maybe some good news for home buyers?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
From Marketplace, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, in for David Brancaccio. Will 2026 be the year that homes finally become more affordable? Tomorrow, we get pending home sales for December. That'll tell us how many homes went under contract. And Zillow recently released a report with some potentially good news for prospective buyers. Their researchers say homes will become affordable in more metro areas by the end of this year. Marketplace's Carla Javier brings us this look at affordability.
To be clear, homes aren't suddenly becoming way more affordable for everyone, says Orfe Divungi at Zillow.
It's going to be a year of small wins.
He says there are three factors.
Incomes have continued to increase. Mortgage rates have actually fallen relative to a year ago. And then the third factor is, of course, prices. Price growth has remained somewhat flat.
He says that median income households buying today have to spend roughly a third of their income on mortgage payments.
Which is high, but it's actually the best it's been since August 2022.
And Zillow forecasts that home buying in some areas could become even closer to affordable by the end of the year. Spending no more than 30% of income on home payments, including property taxes and insurance, is the affordability rule of thumb, says Eric Maribojuk at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
If you start spending more than 30% of your income on housing costs, then it means you're giving up something else.
For Jessica Louts at the National Association of Realtors, affordability this year?
I think it's a very mixed picture.
She says she'll be watching those all-important mortgage interest rates too, and if more inventory comes onto the market and brings prices down. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
The New York Stock Exchange is working on a new platform for digital trading that would allow investors to trade around the clock. The platform would be separate from the NYSE's current exchange, which operates only on weekdays. Let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is down around 1%. The Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P futures are all down around a tenth percent, with the Dow future down around a point. The 10-year Treasury yield is down at 4.29%. Later this week, the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or PCE, for November, is due to be released. It comes as the Federal Reserve prepares to meet for its next meeting on interest rates next week.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by GEP. With GEP Key Agentic AI and GEP Smart Software, GEP is at the forefront in agentic procurement orchestration and autonomous supply chains.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow in the case around President Trump's bid to fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook over mortgage fraud allegations. Cook denies any wrongdoing. She hasn't been charged with any crime. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is set to attend tomorrow's session. The question is, can a president remove a sitting Fed governor? For more, my colleague David Brancaccio spoke with Sarah Binder, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University. Here's that conversation.
The Federal Reserve Act says that presidents can only remove governors for cause. Now, I know HR people around the country deal with for cause all the time. How do you understand that idea of firing for cause?
Well, when Congress writes that, its point is that the president has to have an actual, real, non-policy reason to dismiss an appointee, right? Negligence, inefficiency in office, those phrases go. The president just doesn't have carte blanche to say, I don't like you. I don't like your policy decisions. That's why Congress put that for cause phrase into many of the laws that set up these agencies.
I mean, regardless of what one's view is on the seriousness of the allegations against Lisa Cook, it is fact that they're not proven yet.
Correct. And I think it's important to keep in mind, this isn't a case on the merits. It's not about whether or not there was mortgage fraud here. The key question is, can the president remove Governor Cook while her case, her legal case, works its way through the federal courts?
I mean, is it relevant that the court has, in previous case, allowed President Trump to remove members of various other federal agencies, that he does have latitude when we're not talking about the Fed?
For sure. And in fact, the Supreme Court has basically given carte blanche to President Trump to remove all these other officers that he has fired from various agencies. And in these other cases, the court has kind of left these little breadcrumbs. You know, they say, there's something unique and different about the Federal Reserve. And they've sort of suggested we might treat the effort to remove a governor from the Board of Governors of the Fed, we might treat that action by the president differently.
I mean, if those breadcrumbs have led us astray here and the court were to side with the administration on this, I guess we'd live in a world where the Fed is closer to, I don't know, the National Security Council, where those members serve at the pleasure of the president. I mean, that idea will, I don't know, shake our central banking system.
Absolutely. And even though it's a narrow legal question, it has potentially explosive implications for how the Fed governors make their decisions, but also more importantly, what markets think about the Fed and their commitment to low inflation. And that's why so many people are paying such attention.
Sarah Binder is at Brookings and George Washington University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Emma Condon, Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is news headlines from Morning Edition and National Public Radio. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. We would like to thank the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation for their support. They play a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. They award $30 million in grants and scholarships they have over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org. We'd love to know what you are seeing. Maybe it's snow tracks of a vole. We'd love to hear from you. Send a photo, send a comment to 218-326-1233.